Well, we know what it's like to feel worried and helpless about the state of our world.
But we're finding comfort and inspiration from people tackling winner-take-all economics and other root causes of climate change, inequity, and global unrest.
Join us on the road from wasteland to wonderland. This is Pot of Gold.
Please keep in mind that these recordings may not be as high quality as they usually are because we're doing them in a time of social distancing.
This week, we have a very special interview to share with you for our 20th episode.
Woo! We're speaking with Rivera Sun, author of the novel Billionaire Buddha, and Dario Garner, whose personal story of giving up immense wealth to find happiness inspired the book.
We hope you find their words as enlightening as we did.
So why don't you guys go ahead and introduce yourselves.
Sure. So I'm Rivera Sun. I'm a novelist and an activist. I'm a nonviolence trainer. And I like to do work on changing the story of the world, whether that's in fiction or whether that's in fact, on the ground, in the street, in our minds, wherever that shows up. And that's a great way to summarize the many different ways that I do work in the world. As many of us know, being an artist in these times is also being an activist in these times, and vice versa. Dario, I'll let you introduce yourself.
Okay, I'm Dario Garner, and I'm also an activist. I work in wealth inequality, income inequality. I do a little writing and speaking and things like that. My uniqueness, and I think the reason I'm being interviewed is because I was an extremely successful serial entrepreneur. I formed over 40 businesses in my career with hundreds or thousands of employees and all sorts of different kinds of activities. And at a certain point in my life, about 17 years ago, I saw that it didn't work for me. And I turned my back on wealth and eventually gave everything away. And now I live on a Social Security check and I'm deliriously happy. Just a normal kind of guy.
Truly amazing. 40 over 40 businesses.
Yes, they were all different too. All different, everything from forest products to agricultural products. That was one of my big ones. Farming in Mexico, sending all over the world. Community development, meaning resort community development in the United States. Software for financial institutions, all sorts of different, every business was actually different. Not all of them were successful. A few failed. Most of them were successful. I ended up with hundreds of millions. And at the time I quit, I actually had plans over the 10-year horizon of immediately approved projects. I was primarily in land development at the time, that would have produced over $750 million of profit. I had several hundred million at the time. So it's a lot of money.
What drove you to produce that much wealth?
Wealth, after a while, after the first so many millions, wealth tends to sort of create itself if you let it and you work with it that way. So it became, at some point, there's a question of when is enough, how much is enough. And at some point, clearly I had more than enough. I was one of the, at the time, this is almost 20 years ago. At the time I was one of the 10,000 richest in the United States, which would be many hundreds of millions more than I had at the time today. So I had plenty of money. But you just keep doing it because that's what you do. And you feel like, at least for me, I felt I was part of the system. And to some extent, not trapped, but certainly in the system and of it, without even the ability to change.
So you are also the character Dave Grant Rivera writes about in The Billionaire Buddha. Yeah.
Yes, I'm Dave. Dave Grant's different than me. He's better than me. He's so awesome. He's about three, I actually think three-fourths of the book is literally from my life, but the other fourth of the book I wish was from my life, because Dave does some things that I wish I had done and would certainly do if I was there today. But yeah, he's a cool guy.
Yeah, just to back up a little, as I got to know Daryl and got to know his story a lot better, I, like you, realized that it's a rather unique story, but it's an important one for our culture, where we're very convinced that amassing immense amounts of wealth is going to make us all happy. But there's many people in the 1% and the 0.1% who will tell us a different story. But we don't want to hear that story, right? We want to believe that this lie of American wealth building is going to make us all happy. But it's not true. And Daryl's been there. He's walked that path. And so as a novelist, I thought, if I fictionalize this story, it helps people walk that journey along with the character and maybe see some of the very human things. It's not surprising why it doesn't make us happy, right? These are things that we directly encounter in our own lives about isolation, separation from others, the kind of things we have to do to our heart and our soul in order to amass great wealth, when all along the way there's great suffering that we might have alleviated, right? And so I fictionalized some of Daryl's story, but I also put a lot of the real story in there to kind of guide readers through a journey of walking alongside this character so that they too can consider, is this path going to make myself or our society happier, healthier, with greater well-being for all people?
Yeah, when I first picked up your book, The Billion Buddha, I thought, you know, I didn't really know what's going to be the content of it, because billionaire kind of is $1 billion, kind of clear. And when we normally, let's say this way, when normally there's a book with a topic of money, we touch on, let's say, the behaviorism of it. So how to earn, how to make more, how to invest, you know, all that kind of stuff. And not so much on the emotional dimension of money. So the spirituality of it and our collective consciousness or collective psychology. And I think that is so brilliant. This is what I love so much about your book. You like, you wrap it up in this love story, but you touch the essential things, which are in a way a taboo. We don't really talk about that very much. Are you aware of this at all? Or
yeah, so there are people who will talk about the spirituality and emotionality of money for the express purpose of encouraging us to amass more money, right? There's actually a whole industry of those. And I could talk a lot about the failings of that system and how prosperity gospel reinforces all the social inequities that we live among. You know, it works much better if you're already white and privileged and empowered than if you're not. And that's who it appeals to. But on the other end of spectrums, there is a taboo about talking about the real, the inside story of how this whole thing about amassing wealth is not working. And also how amassing wealth in our culture and many cultures around the world is actually a sociopathic behavior, that it develops sociopathic attitudes in the people who participate in it. And you do have to close down your heart in order to participate in the ways that wealth is amassed in these societies. And speaking with Daryl was something that really illuminated that for me. I come from a different class background. And so hearing the real stories that he was telling, I couldn't believe it. It's the kind of stuff that we like to imagine that's going on behind the scenes with the 1%. But unless you've actually walked that path, you don't know how real and how devastating and horrible it is.
So what exactly happened to, so many people don't even know that they're unhappy. And they're just on the treadmill of making the money and performing happiness, so to speak. What was the transformative moment? I know you speak to it in the book, but perhaps you could tell us directly that made you realize you were so unhappy and you wanted to, that it was related somehow to wealth.
It was amazing because just as you say, I felt I was happy. I thought I was happy. And I got sick. I weighed 365 pounds. And I went to the doctor, and the doctor looked at me and said, "Oh, Daryl," he says, "I feel so envious of you. Here you have enormous wealth. You've got a beautiful wife. You have this tremendous, he knew me because I owned a local resort. You have this beautiful resort on the hill with the Frank Lloyd Wright building and the view. And I can imagine you and your wife having cocktails on the veranda, except in a few years, you won't be there. You'll be dead. And when he told me that I was going to be dead, I actually sat there and I thought, wow, the one thing he doesn't know is that that's fine with me. So I recognized at that instant that that is the very first instant I ever actually realized that I wasn't happy, because I knew that I was absolutely fine with completely dying, that it didn't matter to me. I was happy dying. And I didn't change. I literally kept eating and I kept drinking. I had five-star restaurant, five-star resorts. I had a normal bottle of wine for me was $500 or $1,000. The meals were my, Culinary Institute of America chefs, et cetera, on and on and on, right? And it didn't matter. I kept eating, kept drinking. And then one day I was going into our private dining room with my wife and a new hostess touched me on the shoulder. And that touch was like a touch from God that hit me. I stumbled to my seat. My wife said, what's happening with you? And what the touch had told me was that I could love and be loved. And that's all it was, just the touch of a human being with no sentiments. She didn't know me. She didn't care about me. It was simply the touch that I knew that I could love and be loved. And then actually is when I changed. The next day I started losing weight and I lost 185 pounds in just months, literally, and changed my life. I didn't know it was the money at the time.
Mm.
I went on a search for love. And as I was in the search for love, that's when I realized that the money was what was separating me from love and separating me from everyone else. Because the money, in order to create wealth like I have, you have to close your heart.
Why is that?
Why? You can't be sitting there and signing a payroll check for realizing that someone is going to working hard day and night is going to make $20,000 a year when you make $20,000 an hour. So here I was literally making $20,000 an hour when they were making, most of my employees were making $20,000 a year or $30,000 a year, and not even being able to just understand how they could live on that and having no empathy towards it, not even providing being worth hundreds of millions and not even providing health insurance because, hey, it might cost a few million a year and I may need that few million someday. That kind of closing of the heart is what happens in order to be able to create wealth like that. You close the heart to the people, you close the heart to the environment, you become at least for me, I can't speak for everyone that's wealthy, but at least for me, I couldn't have done it without it. So by closing that heart, I had also forgotten how to love and be loved. And that was the change. So I started giving away money. The more I gave away, the happier I became. And when I finally got rid of it all, it was like, hey, hot damn, you know?
Isn't that amazing, though, that one touch from a stranger could be so transformative?
It was a very fortunate touch, and it took me years years to recognize what all was involved in that, to make the change, to honoring other people, to honoring the environment, to honoring myself, and being able to care for others. But it took years to have that heart blossom out. But it was quite remarkable. People saw the change. I remember my controller, my chief financial officer's wife, I overheard her saying, you wouldn't recognize Daryl anymore. He has a heart. That was quite stunning to have someone say, you have a heart. That implies you didn't have a heart before. None of us like to think we've never had a heart.
It's pretty interesting because it seems that, you know, there is this, our society lives in scarcity. We are in a complete scarcity mode and greed mode. And so what you just described is this greed, even though you're like this super rich guy. And in theory, these two are locked within fear, right? Like fear locks it, but fear giving it away. Or what kind of fear were you experiencing?
I think fear and greed and scarcity are deeply related to inequality, wealth, income inequality, capitalism itself. But these things are also systemic. So there is justifying having hundreds of millions, it may not be because the person's greedy. It may just be because they don't know any better. They don't know to give it away. They don't know that they have a cohort of friends and people that support them. You know, they're not in a vacuum. They have 10 or 12 people around them are giving them severe support. And they're hundreds. And in reality, the entire society supports them. The mega wealthy are supported not just by the Wealth Defense League, but by all of society that thinks that the top, that the people who live in Beverly Hills are superior, that the people who vacation in the Grand Caymans are lucky, or great Hollywood stars are someone to envy. So there's a whole society that supports that kind of thing. So it's not just greed and scarcity and fear, but it is a wealth of other things.
You have to actually turn society on its head imaginatively to really understand it at another level, to think, why aren't we shocked that someone has more than, say, $1 million in their bank account right now, when millions of people don't know where their next meal is going to come from in the U.S., right? Because we have become normalized to this idea of extreme wealth and wealth concentration and building up these reserves, and that's normal. That's applauded. That's thought to be exactly what we should do. We should all be building savings. And if you're the kind of person who will give your last dollar to somebody else to take care of them, people look down on you for that in our society. And I think that's completely backwards. And that's one of the reasons that I wrote the book, and one of the reasons why Dariel does speak about his story so much, is to get us questioning, is this the kind of people we want to be? Is this actually evolutionarily sound? Is this morally correct? And is it, if it's not making us happy in that moment, if we see the suffering that's in the world at all, even in the littlest degree, why is there a gap between seeing suffering and running to the rescue with love, or running to our mutual solidarity with love? Because we also need to deconstruct this notion that wealthy people are the saviors, rather than the fact that all of us together could help heal the wounds that have created great inequality in all of us.
Yeah, it's interesting. You, in the book, talk a lot about the enslavement of people, even those working for wages and just participating in this system. And it seems that even the billionaire himself is a slave, right, to that system. Everyone is, it's not just the people below the 1% or the 0.1%. It's also the 0.1% that's in some ways enslaved, maybe also having power, but still serving that same system.
Yeah, I think enslaved is a strong word, but I would definitely use the word trapped, that we can get trapped in social expectations and business expectations and cultural expectations, and find breaking out of those traps difficult, even when we have all the privileges that society affords the people at the top. And that's part of why we don't have change on these issues. I would say that the wealthy 1% have every right, capacity, and privilege to empower them to make a shift around this, and that's something they could and should consider. But I would say that they do not create this culture on their own. We are all participant in it, setting up expectations. We have to organize at every class level to deconstruct the class war, right? To deconstruct this wealthy hoarding of money. We can feel as a society that no matter where we are in the class spectrum, that we feel a bit trapped in it. Many of us are there because of very obvious, tangible, structural reasons about we work really hard and we're still not paid enough to live on, right? Others are trapped by a whole other slew of conditions that are maybe a little bit less visible, but are worth knowing about because you can't change them until you recognize them.
Do you, in the book, you also are fairly articulate about the criticism of capitalism as a system. Do you have in mind an alternative kind of organized economics that you would propose for the world?
Yeah, that's a big question. I would say I'm critical of capitalism in the context of that novel, specifically because it is a novel about a capitalist. I could lever other criticisms at socialist systems and communist systems as well. I think the key thing to think about with economy is to consider, why have we put our economy, almost no matter what structure it is, at the core of what's being served in our society? Why do we presume, like right now during the pandemic, it's so clear and obvious that the economy cannot be sacrificed without recognizing that an economy in a business field is only a means to an end. And the ends, you know, a sane society should be the well-being of the people and the well-being of the planet upon which the people reside and require for their survival. In our society, that is not what the economy does. The economy gives tidbits back to the worker, the working class, while amassing wealth for the wealthy class. And the reason it holds such a primacy of position in our society and why it hasn't been sacrificed in this pandemic, why we're all bought into this nonsense about jobs, 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 we got to start the economy again, is because our governmental structures and our social structures are all held by the wealthy elites. And so we never consider the things that we could and should be doing to take care of first and foremost people and planet rather than profits and wealth and fortune. We forget that a company is a means to an end, productivity is a means to an end, economy is a means to an end, and we don't criticize what the ends are and how those have been determined. So I would say, rather than proposing a specific alternative system, I would say we need to get our values straight. Because if we don't get our values straight, any system that we use to maneuver and shift and manipulate the money and how it flows from one person to the next is going to recreate patterns of injustices that we are seeing. Now, that said, economic systems with greater democracy, participatory democracy of all the constituents among them, probably tend to be more responsive to the needs and desires of a greater number of people. And that's something we have seen experiments with the early commons-based system, with the current cooperative movement, but we have a lot more experimenting to do, and I hope to see that in my lifetime.
Me too.
Me too.
You know, I think that in answer to your question about capitalism and other alternative systems, I think there's a big clue at the end of the book too, because the end of the book, actually the climax, is an example of nonviolence. Think of that, nonviolence versus violence, because our society and our economic system is created on violence. The property itself, the property system itself that we've lived under, private property that we've lived under for 500 years, was created by violent acts, the taking of the commons. The system that we live in now is enforced by violence, by armies and police, and by fear and scarcity, which breeds scarcity and greed. But the ending of the book is a true act of nonviolence. letting nature go back to nature. What is nature? Become nature. And that's, I think, the real clue as to how to go forward, how to move forward with heart and a nonviolent heart, which would honestly do away with capitalism.
Really challenging the idea of ownership, right? I mean, that's the fundamental act of the book, you know, challenging this idea that of private ownership. And I think for most Americans or even most Westerners, you know, it's almost unfathomable that you could, what would happen if we didn't have property to own and trade and call our own and give our children? And, you know, how would you imagine a world with no ownership? What does that feel like?
Well, let's remember that we created this world. The world of property is literally only about 500 years old that we've had the concept of private property. It is actually a recent concept. So we've created it, it means we can uncreate it. And humorously, as an aside, as that person that had hundreds of millions of dollars, I don't think any of it was in my personal name. It was all trust, and it was all different kinds of vehicles, you know, probably 20 or 30 different corporations and different all over the world, in the Grand Caymans and in Delaware and in all the places that you put things like that. So it's all, quite honestly, there's a lot more illusion as to what wealth is than people recognize.
Hmm. It's just locked away from everyone else.
Yeah, right.
I would also encourage us to expand our imagination sideways, not just to the past, and not just realizing that in the U.S., you know, we enshrined the protection of property when we shifted from the Declaration of Independence to the Constitution by changing the pursuit of happiness to the protection of property. Literally, this is what changes. You got life, liberty, and one of those two things. And so just to remember that we did create this society with great intention and for a particular reason that had to do with amassing wealth and establishing private property as, in its position of primacy. But even now we have so many examples of shared property, communal property, commons, things that are held in common together, but also held in trust together, land trusts, housing cooperatives, cooperative stores, cooperative businesses and workplaces. We have things like Wikipedia, the world's largest commons-based knowledge encyclopedia. The internet for so long has been in this tension between whether or not it's going to become privatized with on-ramps that are akin to enclosures of the commons, that this is a very lively conversation in today's world, and that if you want to imagine it, you should just go do a Google search or a DuckDuckGo search and look for commons and cooperatives and find out what's going on. It's a very lively field, and honestly, it's beautiful. It's incredible. It's not scary. It's not based in scarcity. In fact, it feels abundant compared to our everyday world of private property and stores and buying and selling, tool co-ops and child co-ops and bike sharing programs. It's really remarkable what's going on in the world.
Is this not going a little bit against the American dream?
Absolutely. Well, I think we need to stop laughing about that one. Yeah. I think you have to ask the question, whose dream was that and where did that come from? What did that mean? Who invented it and why has it been perpetuated? The American dream conveniently reinforces the notion that each and every single one of us is going to have to buy a certain amount of things in our lives, and thus we're going to have to work really hard to get those things. This is a very convenient narrative for a certain group of people, and it's extremely inconvenient for the rest of us, in which we're always aspiring to own all these things that most of us can't afford to own, and then measuring our social worth against that, whether we've achieved it or not achieved it. Are we winners or losers, failures or victors? And that's a bogus concept, right? So what really could be an American dream rooted in the other parts of our humanity? an American dream in which our fullest creative expression was unleashed, our fullest love-based expression was unleashed, our fullest potential of healing on a social and spiritual and cultural level was unleashed, our fullest potential in terms of relating to and caring with our environment. All of these things are pieces of what could be our American dream that are often left out of the equation, but are actually the things that make us happy as human beings. There is a study that shows that, you know, a certain amount of money in your life helps make increase your happiness. It's right around $70,000. But above that range, above the meeting the basic necessities of life in our culture, and I want to name that our poverty line is not our basic necessities. It's actually more between $50,000 and $70,000, depending on where you live in this country. Beyond that point, there's diminishing returns for happiness, right? So making more money than that is not what's going to make us happy. And why are we pursuing the protection of property versus the pursuit of happiness? We should all be asking ourselves those questions.
I mean, we do know there are some countries. I think is it Bhutan that has the gross national happiness index, or like, to what extent does measurement even matter in this context?
I mean, yeah, I think they're all subjective measurements, but I think daring to measure things differently and take assessment of where we're at can be very informative for understanding what's not working, and to understand what we're valuing in our society is reflective in what we measure and what we don't measure. And then even doing some things with the measurements we take. For example, gross national product, if you divide that by all the people in this country, every man, woman, and child ought to be making $60,000 a year. So our country is productive enough to more than meet our needs that we have assessed for basic happiness levels. Far more. A family of four is making $240,000 a year. Most of us can't even imagine that.
And also, if you took the wealth of the United States and divided it just by the number of people, you'd come out with a net worth for a family, if it were shared equally. Every family of four would be worth about $1.3 million net.
With no debt.
With no debt. $1.3 million, no debt. And that $250,000 of annual income would be virtually tax-free if income were shared equally also.
This is the wealth that's generated by the work that we do. Just to boil down very complex statistics, and by the resources that we hold. And there's a lot of things we could look at in there about, do we need to be doing this kind of work versus that kind of work? You know, what kind of work do we not have to be doing in our culture? These are questions that I would love to see our culture grappling with more profoundly. And that's one of the reasons that Daryl and I do these kind of talks. Daryl talks about his story because he very much bought into that American dream on steroids, right? The billionaire American dream versus the, you know, the little house with the picket fence American dream. But also, you know, when we have seen through the lies, we should be public about speaking up to that. And say, wow, I've walked that path. I bought that advertisement and then I got that product and they came here and it really wasn't what I thought it was going to be like. Yeah. And so, yeah, what is it that we're really seeking?
So how do you live today?
I'm deliriously happy. I mean, you know, it's I have more friends than I've ever had. I'm freer certainly than I've ever been in my life. We live very modestly, but very happily. There's, you know, hobbies, all kinds of things. Everything. I think, I miss, the only thing I miss, honestly, is the quality of healthcare that I had as a, you know, there's a real difference between being able to buy a hospital and not being able to get into one.
That's a failure in public policy for sure, you know, that you can't even get into a hospital.
Yeah, but you said you're freer, which is actually the promise of for any immigrant coming or arriving here in the United States. That's freedom. Which is a bit controversial to the American dream, yeah, as we just discussed.
I also think, again, asking provocative questions, this alleged American freedom, which we know is not applied equally in our society, what brought us that? It wasn't this idea of capitalism. Capitalism doesn't make us free. Mm-hmm. Having more cereals on the shelf doesn't actually equate to social and cultural and political freedoms. What has made us, what has got any measure of freedom in this society has been organized movements for change by people who perceive themselves to be lacking freedom to begin with. And we got a certain set of those with early white European American colonists who assured certain freedoms for 6% of the population, the propertied white males. And then we've been in a long journey of every other group of people who have ever come to or lived upon this continent, striving for political, social, economic freedoms that are what we summarize as American freedom. So capitalism doesn't bring us these things. Money doesn't bring us these things. Consumerism doesn't bring us these things. What bring us these things are people demanding them, often unpaid, often suffering from some of the negative impacts of the way we organize wealth and money in our culture. And we should always be aware of that when we start talking about freedom.
I think, Steph, also you mentioned the American dream, and I think it's important to point out how much of an illusion it actually is. The number of that dream of making more money than your parents had or making enough to be free, it doesn't work. In the United States, the half of all the people in the United States, if you combine their net worth together, meaning added up everything they're worth that they own and subtract everything they owe, their net worth combined would be, for 47% of them, would be zero. Meaning that half the people in this country combined don't have anything at all. That's why it's so easy to say that there are 3 billionaires that own more than half the people. Of course, because the other people don't, they don't have anything. So for half the people in the country, 170 million people, it doesn't work at all. If you're black, it's even worse. Or if you're Native American, it's even worse. The typical family net worth in the Boston metro area for a black family is $8. That's the net worth, like $8. And that's $8. That's not a typo.
I think the average white family's net worth is something like 247.
No, it's 100,000. Average family's around 117 or something like that. White family. Average family, I think, is around 67 or something, 60,000. That's net worth versus a fair share net worth of a family like that is well over $1 million. So that's how unequal we are. And that's how the possibility of achieving that American dream is just about nothing. There is virtually, the social mobility in the country is less than what we used to call caste-ridden India, meaning that you're less likely to rise in your social class in the United States than you are in India currently. Our wealth inequality is higher than it was in feudal times. It's higher than it was in the slave days of the Roman Empire. We're actually the most unequal country in the world, which I'm sure you all are aware of, in the history of the world, most unequal in the history of the world. So the American dream really doesn't work. And then for the few of us that it does work, what's the toll it takes? If it means closing your heart off to everyone else and to the world around you, and if it means drinking yourself into a hole or going into all sorts of other activities that happen to many wealthy people, you just don't want to go there. It doesn't really work for anybody. Anyway, sorry for my rant.
Shift the conversation just a little bit to the current day. And Rivera, you mentioned the COVID situation that we're in, kind of showing us that we don't need so much economic activity necessarily. Could you speak a little more to that idea that, you know, maybe productivity is overrated?
Productivity is definitely overrated. The end results and the end goals of productivity in terms of well-being of the people are generally underrated. The benefits of having the results of productivity go to a handful of people are also overrated in our society. The idea that a rising tide will actually lift those boats is totally bogus and has been disproven lots of times. But you know, I think when we look at things like the pandemic and the upheavals in our society, one of the questions that people are starting to raise is, you know, are bunkers for the 1% going to actually do the trick? Are they going to be able to survive the collapses that we're living through? Can they ever amass enough wealth to protect themselves? And the answer is really flat out no. No, it won't. Not with the goals of having a livable planet for your children, for sure. And I think, you know, the question that we are starting to ask ourselves more and more is what builds resiliency in entire communities in which the well-being of a 1%er, a 99%er, heck, the whole 100% is best assured. It's never certain, but it's best assured by putting resiliency into as many people and as many structures and as many systems as possible. And this means rearranging the way that we do almost everything in US society, because individualism is not resilience. And if we look at human history, we are hardwired biologically and evolutionarily to be cooperative and collaborative, not competitive. And Darwin's work, this relates so deeply. Darwin barely ever mentioned survival of the fittest. He mentioned cooperation and collaboration hundreds of times in his work. But why do we know about survival of the fittest? Because it was economically advantageous to a class of people who wanted to pretend that they were the fittest and they deserved all the money. So we need to debunk these kind of narratives and myths and reinstate in our hearts and our minds the understanding that resilience, cooperation, collaboration, taking care of our communities are the things that make us safer, the things that make us more likely to endure as a species, the things that make us happier, that make us connected to one another and able to look each other in the eyes with mutual respect.
Any advice to people, to our listeners? Anything you would really love to say as a last word?
Yeah, I would say it's a quote from one of her other novels, and that's be kind, be connected, and be unafraid.
Yeah, I would only add to that that Daryl and I do a fair bit of work talking to people who actually have similar stories to Daryl. Either they've made a lot of money and given it away, or they inherited money and they gave it away, or they stopped the money from coming to them to begin with. They structured their businesses so the workers got the money, or they paid their fair share or paid their dues before they let anything flow to them. And these stories are actually far more common than we're led to believe, and we're really committed to picking them up and circulating them and sharing them so that we can start to tell a different story together, be honest about the failings of the stories that we've inherited, and be boldly imaginative about the stories that we could live and breathe into together when we dare to let go of what we've been given.
Wonderful. I am truly grateful to have met you guys and to have read the book, actually, that the book kind of came to me, I guess, and then pass it on to Mel. Yeah. No, really, truly grateful. Thank you so much for your time.
I have one last quick question. Are you, Rivera, are you Joan in the book, or is that someone else?
People ask me that all the time, and there's a very diversity of opinion on this subject, but I don't see myself as Joan. I do like her as a character.
I think she is, but that's okay.
She's a great character.
Yeah. Awesome.
And I would just say that, you know, if people are looking for the book, it is all over the place, you know, on all the major online bookstores. But if you'd like to get it from someone who's not a billionaire, you can actually get it at my website, www.riverasun.com.
Yes, please. Yes.
And yeah, thank you.
We'll put it in the show notes.
Awesome. Okay. Thank you so much for your time.
We're an independent, listener-supported podcast.
Thanks to our producer, Riley Paul.
Support us by rating this episode and sharing with all your friends.
And to learn more, join us at potofgold.world.
I'm Stephanie Overbach.
And I'm Mel Wymore.
Thanks for listening.